gives us a little time, and here we are. Okay. Welcome to Drinks and Shrinks. I am your host, Peter Anderson.
And I am Jessica Pacinas.
And we are here wanting to talk about managing anxiety in a crazy world. So, what are you drinking, Jessica?
You're probably going to hear a lot of this from me this fall. I'm obsessed with pumpkin, all things pumpkin. So I actually have a nice pumpkin coffee, pumpkin spice coffee. It's my go-to. I love it. Nice.
I heard Starbucks, you just can't beat Starbucks pumpkin spice latte. I've just heard.
They are phenomenal. Go get one.
I live right next door to one. I live like two blocks away from a Starbucks, and I really meant to go get my pumpkin spice latte for the, I'm getting over a sore throat. So excuse my voice, but today I'm drinking chamomile and green tea, but it's helping. And,
that's good. That's good.
Yeah. No scotch right now. So everybody, we're meeting at 10:30 in the morning. Eventually we will have maybe a little glass of wine if we do this podcast a little later, as we said, it's drinks or shrinks. So we're just going to have a nice conversation about anxiety. So Jessica, you want to go first, and what kind of anxiety do you see, and how do you manage anxiety with your clients? And love to hear from you. And we're just going to talk about that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Peter. Sorry.
So I was just wondering how do you define anxiety? You know, so those are some of my questions. What is your take on that?
Definitely. You know, I think, so first let me say, I think anxiety sometimes can be really misunderstood emotion. And anxiety to me is, you know, a very well-intentioned emotion. It's that body's alarm system that kind of goes off saying danger, danger, but what it perceives as danger isn't always the threat isn't always as extreme in reality, but our minds don't always process that. They just say danger, danger, there's a threat, that alarm bell's going off, and we can go into that fight, flight, or freeze. And so in that way, anxiety is intentioned to help us, right? To get out of that dangerous situation. So in that way, again, I think it can be misunderstood, but the effects that it can create, the impact of anxiety, can be very distressing. We can get stuck in those loops of thinking, like those automatic negative thoughts, those ants, as I call them, where, you know, it's catastrophizing a situation, or it's that danger around the corner, or what if thinking is another big one I see. It can also be shutting down. And avoiding things. So I see a lot of different presentations of it. And I don't know if that's something, Peter, that you see as well in working with people, right? Just the urgency, the keyed up energy behind anxiety. Is that, what are the presentations you typically see?
Yeah. I like how you said, just like the constant fear or the dread. I come in anxiety. I don't know if you're aware of like internal family systems, IFS, to tell our listeners, I was really influenced by a guy named Dick Schwartz, and he came up with a system called internal family systems that says that we have these different parts inside of us called managers that like to have a lot of control, firefighters that kind of want to escape because the stress is too crazy. And then exiles that seem to carry a lot of our hurt and pain. I mean, that's a very generalized, you know, explanation of it. But I always found that anxious parts are highly logical, and like you can't outwit them because these are parts of us, parts of my clients that have like whenever I've tried to, I don't want to say argue, but like, you know, go back and forth with a highly anxious part, that anxious part almost like wins out all the time, because they've always thought of like the worst possible situation and they're thinking way ahead. And it's, right. You know, it's, they can be highly logical at times, to a fault. Yeah. And that's kind of, but I mean, it's in some ways I see anxiety as you said, it's a natural source of our condition that is not always bad. In fact, if we didn't have anxiety, certain types of anxiety, we probably wouldn't survive very, very long. And so it's not And there are certain times that anxiety comes out where it needs to come out. So if I'm feeling very anxious, walking down a dark path, or in this case, if I'm about to enter into a really unhealthy relationship, you know, we're both relationship yes. counselors. And I've had people that I've spoken to that they felt a lot of anxiety in this relationship, even though the person was presenting as like really safe and secure. And they modeled this type of like caring, you know, affect. And yet there was this deep rooted anxiety, like something's not right. And then later in the relationship, maybe even after marriage, or maybe after like a child, or maybe after just like years of investment, they started kind of seeing some things that their original gut may have told them to be careful of. So yeah, anxiety is not always we immediately think or attribute anxiety as something as a negative, but I always tell people it doesn't always have to be a negative. And sometimes it could be a positive. Sometimes it could be like your gut just saying, hey, you better watch out. Yeah,
exactly. I think there's so much truth to that. And I think our bodies hold memory. And sometimes when anxiety comes up in that example you were giving in that relationship, sometimes our minds struggle to shift in that it's hard to differentiate maybe experiences someone might have had in a past relationship, for example, with going into a new one, right? So that anxiety can spark up because it's saying, hey, watch out, right? We've been down this road before. You don't want to do this again. And right. it's hyper vigilant and look for things. And I think in that way, again, it's protective. It's trying to protect you. But I think sometimes it's understanding what's behind it, which is the hard part. Cause like we're saying it's rooted in things that are logical, that there might be some kind of basis for, right? And, you know, what is that? Where does that come from? What is my anxiety really trying to tell me about the situation? What's that underlying need there or concern? Yeah. What am I really concerned or afraid about here?
I like that. Love the way you're dialoguing with that part too, because that's exactly where IFS would say. It's like, don't immediately judge this part of you. And I think that's actually where anxiety gets a lot worse when you try to, you know, in a Freudian sense, stuff down those ideas or those parts. It often will kind of come out again in a very destructive way, or maybe in a very defensive way. So what are some ways, and that's why I wanted to title this Managing Anxiety, because anxiety doesn't always have to be bad, rather than just like getting rid of anxiety. So what we want to kind of talk to y'all about is like, how do you manage your anxiety? So I guess we're both couples therapists, but we don't have to just look at that. But what are some of the typical anxious situations that you often see that can be very debilitating, either in a relationship or for an individual? What are some things that you see? And I'll have to think about. And feel free. I need to ask. Maybe I should answer questions first, too.
No, it's good. It gets me thinking, right? The pumpkin spice better be working there.
I know, tea is it. We don't have as much caffeine as you do. So yeah, I'm taking it.
You know, I think, and I don't know if this answers your question, but I'm just going to go with it. So I think with anxiety, what can be really tricky is that it can present in ways where it's not always concise. It can be messy. It can be, you know, impulsive is not the right word, but it comes up in ways that might be a little bit barbed in a relationship setting, where it might not make all that much sense at first, or agitated. That's the word I'm looking for. Agitated, irritated. Yeah. And I think sometimes it can be mistaken for, oh, you're just upset with me. And it can create then, especially in a relationship setting, a disconnect. Right. And I think individually, it uproots us. It's hard to stay present. It's hard to stay focused. It's hard to, you know, you could be trying to get a task done, but your mind is off somewhere else, dwelling and ruminating over this thing. Or in your body, you just feel so restless and so at odds with yourself. It is debilitating. It can be. And I think one of the things is because it also is physiological and how it feels for an individual, I think it's so important to also try to find things. And this is where I think strategies and managing it range for each individual person is finding things that help you to ground, helping things that create a sense of safety, to self-soothe a little bit, to relax your body. And maybe that for some people is that deep breathing, that diaphragmatic breathing. Maybe it's tapping into your senses. I think that's a really powerful one that works for a lot of people, is walking through your senses, because it redirects. It redirects what my focus is on. And then once my body is a little more at ease, then maybe I can take another look at that anxiety and try to figure out what's behind it there. What is really concerning to me. But if I'm trying to do that too quick, I'm not going to be able to get there.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. No. And I love that you're bringing up the body, because I mean, I think that's one of the things that I think a lot of people, they'll immediately assume all these complex things about like anxiety is purely in the mind. And what I've realized that it's actually much more part of your body than you realize. And
yeah.
there's a really well-known quote by Alan DeBottom. And I'm just going to, where he says, "It isn't disrespectful to the complexity of existence to suggest that despair is, at times, just low blood sugar and exhaustion." You know, and what he means by that is just kind of like, sometimes I think we overthink. If we're having this huge amount of anxiety, it must be like I'm immediately being irrational, or I just look at it from a mind perspective rather than. It could be like my diet. It could be my exercise or lack thereof. It could also just be not listening, you know, to my GI. And my GI is kind of like reacting. Maybe I'm not hydrated. Maybe I'm like too caffeinated versus like I haven't drunk any caffeine. And maybe, you know, it's, or the huge cause is insomnia. And Matthew Walker, his wonderful book on sleep, really talks a lot about that. It's one of the biggest, contributors to anxiety. It's also the thing that I think a lot of us in the psychodynamic field can often ignore. It's a question that I'm guilty of not always asking my clients, like, how's your sleep? Like, have you, you know, and if they're saying, gosh, I only got like 2 to 3 hours every night, and they're coming to my office and they're saying, yeah, I'm debilitated with anxiety. I'm actually much more concerned about their sleep than I am about tackling the anxiety. It's kind of like that whole Maslow's pyramid. It's like, okay, we're going to just figure out your physiological base right here. We're going to help you. Let's get into a sleep study. Let's maybe stop the scrolling on texting and whatnot at the very end of night, in the evening, and just putting your cell phone away and just trying to meditate, maybe getting a salt bath. Can we try that for like 2 weeks? And, you know, I love how you just, because I mean, I think with anxiety, we always want to ask like a lot of questions at first about how are you taking care of yourself? And, right. But it can be very, like what you said, very debilitating. I think that anxiety is so, there's the common theme, like depression is focused on the past and anxiety is focused on the future.
Yes, I've heard that one too.
I mean, what do you think about, I say that a lot too, but I mean, would you say that's, is that too simple or is it more, it's probably more complex than that, I would say.
Well, I appreciate that. But I think a part of me can understand where that comes from. And at the same time, I think anxiety also can come from the past as well, about sometimes things maybe that we can't change, especially too in thinking about loss and grief, right? That should have, could have, would have thinking. Or what if it just happened this way? I think all of those things, yes, they're more focused on the past, but they can also bring up such anxiety, that loss of control. And so I definitely think with that, yes, I think there's definitely truth, but I also think there's a lot of layers to that. But it does make sense, because with that loss of control, and I think also that kind of catastrophizing or that anticipation that can come with things in the future, You know, I definitely can see that future focus.
So what are some, I love that. I mean, and that's a good reframe, because I think that's, the whole should have, and I could have done this, and feeling the anxious that I totally lost control and therefore my future is going to be a disaster. And
the interplay between them.
Yeah. I don't know. I often see that with people who are struggling a lot with addiction. You know, they have this kind of mentality, and I'll talk about this a lot as well. Like I call it like a starting over mentality, where they feel like if I mess up, everything's going to go all the way back to square one. And, you know, and it's just the anxiety to perform in a particular way. And that's where a lot of shame comes in, and they're beating themselves up. It could be wanting to prove to their partner that they're trustworthy. It could be a kid really, really wanting to prove to his parents that he's doing better. You know, trying to think things I often see too. I know it's very rooted in like performance based, like procrastination. I often see is not so much laziness, but is more like a fear of failure. You know, it's like, I'm so afraid I'm going to mess this up. It's, you know, I think there's this connection to our history where we're no longer curious or engaged. We immediately just kind of make these predictions. This is what's going to happen. And, you know, which is why I think CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy, which I try to use, and I could talk about that in a minute, or DBT for short, okay, that is really helpful, because it gets people to be more curious and dialogue more on what the situation may be, rather than just immediately assume what the situation is, what the outcome is going to be based on past experience. And we see that a lot with, marriages too, the whole mind reading. And, you know, it's like, I'm anxious because this has happened and therefore this is going to happen. So what are some ways that we treat anxiety? I mean, I don't mind. I'm asking you tons of questions.
I'm ready to go. This coffee is helping.
No, right. Well, all right, fine. If you're right, next time, we're going to make this a dialogue, folks. This is not just Peter interviewing Jessica the whole time. It's all that, a lot of pressure on you. But what are some ways that you treat it? Yeah, you found helpful.
No, I appreciate that. I also tend to gravitate more to CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, because one, so from the thought standpoint that we were talking about a little bit earlier, I think giving people tools to be able, one, to identify when there's one of those cognitive distortions, automatic negative thoughts present. So it's hard to catch them if we don't know what they look like. So mind reading being one of them, should thinking being another, that all or nothing, black and white type of thinking. There are different kinds. And so once you can recognize, oh, like I'm feeling this way, let me check in, right? So this relationship between thoughts, feelings, behaviors. So, oh, like if I'm able to notice, I'm really not okay right now. I'm feeling so overwhelmed, so anxious. What are my thoughts, right? Is this way of thinking helpful? Is it unhelpful? Do I have proof for that thought? I kind of talk to a lot of my clients about putting their thoughts on trial about, do I really have evidence for that thought? Is that tangible evidence? And oftentimes people won't find it. And when you come up with evidence for versus against, right, and kind of that more of that thought record approach, it allows you to then take the facts of the situation, to strip away some of that emotion from it, and to say, okay, well, based on what I'm finding here in the situation that's presenting itself, there's a new thought that can be found. And when I think about this way of thinking, how does that shift how I feel about it, or what I'm able to do, what the choices are before me? And I think in that way, it's also giving you that sense of control in a situation that feels out of your control. And then, you know, from some of that DBT work, I think also that what's really hard is that idea of radical acceptance, you know, accepting a situation as it is. And I think when you're able to do that, it does alleviate a lot of the suffering and agonizing. So sometimes when you're able to say, this is the situation, I can't change it. These are the things that are beyond my control, but this is what's in my control. This is something that I can do, right? So in accepting it, again, you're finding out what steps can I take here. And then of course, doing more of the self-soothing, the grounding, really being in tune with your body. So how do I release tension from my body? How do I increase focus on what's in the here and now, bringing myself back from whatever the thoughts are, but just turning into myself a little bit. So that way I'm kind of creating this sense of stability versus chaos that's internally happening. I'm bringing that stability back. And I think that's where I encourage people to think about over the course of a week, when I'm overwhelmed, do I like silence? Do I love listening to music and need to blast it? Do I want to sit and binge watch a funny show, or do I want to go for that run? For all of us, we have a different toolbox. And I think it's about figuring out, what can I put in that toolbox? How do I build that toolbox when I'm not feeling anxious or overwhelmed? So I know it's there when I need it. Because it's a lot harder to come up with those things in the heat of the moment. What are your thoughts, Peter? What do you find?
Yeah, I love that.
You talk a lot of, yeah.
Yeah, no, I love, I definitely use CBT and my silence is just like, wow, she's saying really good things. So I love that. No, I like CBT. I also would say evidence for and then evidence against too. And like I try to get, because usually, you know, evidence. So what I often tell people is like, you know, the basic, so if listeners don't know what CBT is, it's actually considered one of the most effective, if not the most effective tool to manage anxiety. And what you want to do is you could look at the cognitive fallacies that we often have. And maybe we can kind of like link in this podcast, like a website that they could do, that they can go to, such as like, you know, when we catastrophize, all or nothing thinking, black or white thinking, you know, so that's the first thing. And you want to describe what the situation is, what you're feeling, and then what's the evidence for, you know, the anxious thought. Mm-hmm. So if I'm totally paranoid about, or very, very anxious about getting on this airplane, what's the evidence for? Well, I just saw a crash on the air. I just saw airplane crash on the front, mm-hmm. you know, page of the news. And airplanes, if they crash, the likelihood of death is like 99.9%. And like, mm-hmm. then they go through that. And then you have to validate that the evidence for, because again, it's like listening to that. But then you want to say, okay, what's the evidence against that? Well, the likelihood of you dying in an airplane crash is like getting struck by lightning 5 times in a row in the middle of a field without a storm, you know, and you can just like, you can keep going down. And then what you do is that you measure your anxiety again, and hopefully it goes from like a 10 to maybe a 7. And then you just kind of do it again, and you do it again, and you do like different, you dialogue a little bit more until it's somewhat manageable. And that could be very effective. One of the things I do with clients is what you said, like DBT. I would be curious about what form of DBT you do. Cause there's a huge spectrum of DBT, dialect.
Yes.
So the one I do is kicking out your but statements. And, so what I often tell people is that your brain loves binaries to a fault. And it's not always healthy. Our brains love something that our bodies aren't, or our mental health, that doesn't always help our mental health. So our brains love the polarization. It often feels stuck. And so we often feel like we have to do an either or. And so, you know, so a but statement is a good example of that. So if I say to, if you were to invite me to a party and you'd say, hey, Peter, would you like to go to the party tonight? My husband and I are putting, this evening. And I say to you, well, Jessica, I would love to go, but I'm anxious. The likelihood of me going is going to be pretty low because I just invalidated myself. My brain is sticking to that one message. If I were to say to you, Jessica, I really like what you're saying, but I think you're full of crap. Okay, right. So I mean, you're not, right. Don't you feel validated? Right. Or if I say, hey, Jessica, I really like what you're saying, but I have a totally different opinion. You're going to feel like, okay, wow, we're getting into an argument. And so what I say to people is like, try to kick out those butts and see what happens. And so if you were to invite me to the party and say, hey, my husband and I are going to, you know, we're just throwing a party. And I say, hey, I'd love to go to the party. And I do happen to be anxious today. You and I are dialoguing. We're going to keep talking. I just kicked out the butt statement. I'm no longer invalidating. What that does is that the brain is holding on to two things that are true. I love my wife, but I'm angry with her. Ooh, that's not good, right? I love my wife and she's kind of irritating me right now. Or I love my husband and he's annoying me. Okay, cool. Yeah. Like, hey, drink. Welcome to the crowd. And it's like, it really helps a whole lot. So DBT can be very good for people who have maybe borderline or people who maybe even like grow up in a more religious environment that they kind of feel like they have to make a choice between this or this, where it's like, it's okay that two things can be true at once.
Yes.
Yeah. And my wife was asking me if I'm dying. I'm like, no, I'm not done. What kind of DBT? I mean, when you said you did DBT, what kind do you use? And is it a different form? I just want to give our listeners.
I think there is a lot to what you were saying, because that's so true about challenging this binary that we kind of live in. And also on a macro level, I think we're also inundated a lot with. So it's really freeing to be able to hold two things at once. It doesn't have to be either or. And you're right. It opens up a dialogue. And when you open up a dialogue, it allows one, you're letting it out. You're releasing it in some way. So it's not just pent up in your body and you're holding on to this thing that doesn't feel good. But now I'm actually putting it out there. I'm confronting it. I kind of equate this to that a storm with a shadow on the wall and the kid gets really afraid. And when you turn on the light, you realize it's just a tree branch. You need to figure out what it is. And so when you open up a dialogue, sometimes just in talking, you're processing a little bit about where that's coming from. So I think that's huge. I think with DBT for me, I tend to gravitate to, again, some of those more sensory related tasks about being able to fall back into what, you know, I feel, what I see, touch, see, hear, smell, taste, really tuning into some of those types of strategies. I also, a little bit more on the mindfulness side. The other thing though, I think I mentioned it a little earlier, is that idea of radical acceptance. Because sometimes again, with anxiety especially, we're so focused on the things that are outside of our control, the things that we can't change, the things that, you know, we wish was another way. And again, it's amplifying it. It's amplifying that sense of out of control. It's amplifying the fear, the stress. And so when you're able to turn into, well, it is what it is, as scary of a statement as that is, I can open my mind and my heart to accepting that, then it allows me to think about, okay, well, if this is what it is, what can I do about it? Mm-hmm. It's putting something back into the realm where I have some agency. Because I think sometimes with anxiety, we lose that sense of agency. So that's a big one. I really like that. I guess more at the foundational level of how I approach it.
It's amazing, like when a client feels like they're completely in a passive role rather than an active role, how radically different that is. I was just talking to a friend recently, and he felt really bombarded about how difficult this particular situation was, because I think he really just kind of felt like he was just passive. And then I asked him, I was like, well, what do you want? Like, do you want this particular thing going on in your life? And he was like, I never thought of that. It's like, but what do you want? You know, it's like, and often we'll ask that about a relationship, like people that are feeling really anxious about this person, maybe breaking up with them or doing something. And they often see themselves only in the passive role. And psychologists kind of talk about outer locus of control. Like you feel like you're being dominated by the spirits or the certain forces outside of your element, and you're kind of just the recipient of that. And that's a very anxious feeling. Where if you can focus on inner locus of control, what do you know? How do you engage? Is this a relationship you want? Do you want a partner that does not really want to be in a relationship with you? Like, do you really, really want that? Do you want to be so involved in your kid's life where you get to the point where you don't even like them very much? Like, what do you want? Like, or do you actually like, which, and then they often say like, no, I would love that separation a little bit. Or it's like, okay, how can we put yourself in there? Like helping them get into the avenues where you know, of agency is really helpful from passive to active. And I mean, we could keep talking about this for another hour, honestly. So
I love this topic. So I really
I do too. Yeah. I feel like we're just scratching the surface. I mean, I mean, because there's so many elements to this that are just really fascinating. The evolution of anxiety, where it stems from, you know, we didn't even talk about loneliness and, you know, how anxiety contributes to depression and when anxiety can be so debilitating, agoraphobia and certain types of phobias. We could talk about phobias, but we wanted to keep this semi short for all of you, but feel free to, I don't know if you wanted to say anything before I close out, because I would love to hear your concluding thoughts too.
Final thoughts.
I also know you have a client like a few minutes, so that's why.
I would say that I agree. We're scratching the surface, and there are so many different avenues that we can take this conversation. So I would love to hear from people too about if there's anything they want us to talk more about. But I also think a little to think also about some context is the pandemic and the impact that has also created on, experiences of anxiety. And so I think this idea of loss of control, I know in my personal life and from what I hear about with a lot of my clients, rings true. It has been such a time of a loss of control, and it creates such a heightened level of distress. And so I think, just trying to pause, get off autopilot, to really check in with yourselves, to focus on what are my needs, what are the things that I need to create stability, security, structure in my own life. To ask yourself some of those questions. I would love just to hear more from people about what they might want to hear on this topic.
Please.
But do you have any final thoughts, Peter, on this? No.
And also, I just wanted to lead everybody to Anderson Family course page. If y'all want to go to our course pages, Anderson Family, AndersonFamTherapy.com, and you can look at our Relationship Institute course. We talk a lot about helping clients dialogue through some really difficult things. You have some really great series on intimacy. We also have something on the foundations, and I did something on affairs. And so, we'd love to, that's all for you. And we would love to hear from our audience. We really would. I mean, please let us know. This is for you, for all of you. We're doing this not just to have fun conversations, as much as we really enjoy each other's company. We're doing this really for our audience. We want to hear from all of you. We love more detailed questions. And, maybe we could even have a few of those up next time. And one of these, we'd love to maybe even do like a live session where the more our audience grows, we can hear from a lot of you. So there's a really funny YouTube clip. Y'all should check it out. It's not Bob Hope. It's the guy that says, "Stop it." And
yes, I know that one. It was Mad TV or something.
Mad TV. So we encourage on a humorous recommendation, just go to YouTube and type in "Stop it" therapy, and it's pretty hilarious. That's how you don't deal with anxiety, but
it's so true. So, I'm not recommending that in real life.
All right, well, thanks everyone for listening. This is Drinks with Shrinks with Jessica and Peter, and we hope to hear from you soon. All right, we'll see you all next time.
See you next time. Bye
bye.